next, the International Connection in color.
Well, you're listening to the International Connection. This is the regular edition when we normally go on the air, or when we used to normally go on the air. And indeed, I have my first guest with me today, and it's a pleasure to have him on the line. A surprise, really. I never expected that we'd do it. And I have to thank Wayne Morris for at least putting it a little bit in motion, the former host of the International Connection. And on the line with me, without further ado, is Delbert Vreeland. Mike. Hello, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, where do we begin with your story? It's an incredible story. You've been in jail for, you said 17 months?
17 months, yes.
And you're now free, so to speak.
So to speak.
You're not in jail anymore. We've been following your story, which first really came to light because of the September 11th World Trade Center attack. That's what made it into a media story. As far as I knew, wasn't really in the press or in the public eye before that. This all started quite a bit of time before that. I should just tell the audience that, I don't know, what should I call you, Mike or Vreeland, or what would you prefer?
Mike's fine.
Mike. Okay, Mike. You told us that you can tell us things that are in the public record, so forgive me if I stray or question into an area that you just can't talk about. So just so that the audience knows that before we go any further, tell me, when did this nightmare begin for you?
The day they arrested me on December 6th of 2000.
And what precipitated that arrest, as far as you can tell?
I still don't really have any specific idea of why it was they arrested me. It went from them accusing me of one charge to them accusing me of six charges to them dropping all of the charges because they were all garbage 2 years later. That the night they arrested me, they said it was for fraud, and that's basically all I knew at that time. They said, "You're being arrested for fraud." Those were the exact words that they used. It was it.
Where were you exactly arrested?
Downtown Toronto.
Uh-huh. Was there any warning to this when you, did you have any warning that this might occur?
Well, actually, I had a piece of paper that had it on there that said something was going to happen to me and someone else, but it was written in Russian, and I did not go through the documents, didn't read them, so I was not positive exactly what was going on.
They were in Russian?
Yeah,
in the Russian language. We should explain here now. Maybe I'm not explaining and introducing this properly. You have claimed in court that you are a member, or you're employed by the U.S. government. You're in naval intelligence. And can you explain to me what your job is as far as you're concerned, or what it was?
I was a courier.
Uh-huh. And you're working for the U.S. Naval Intelligence?
Yes.
I should say, just anecdotally, you're... A family has a long history in U.S. Naval Intelligence. Maybe you want to tell us a little bit about that, just briefly.
My family's military history goes all the way back to the Civil War in the United States. My great-grandfather was about third in command in the U.S. Navy back in, around 1880, 1901, somewhere around there. I don't know the exact years. My father, he was in the military. My stepfather was in the military. My brothers were in the military. My whole family pretty much was in the military.
You're not a Canadian, obviously. You're from the United States. Where had you come from? What brought you to Canada?
I came into Canada from Moscow.
And how long had you been in Moscow?
About 4 days.
And prior to that, you'd been in the United States?
No.
Okay.
I went to Moscow from Sudbury.
From Sudbury?
Yes.
And how long had you been in Sudbury?
Just awaiting probably about a day.
Okay. And is there anything special about Sudbury we should know?
No.
Okay. It's a strange place to go, to be heading over to Moscow. I don't know any international flights that are leaving from Sudbury, but...
I didn't leave on an international flight.
Okay.
We were in private planes.
Private planes. All right. Interesting. Okay, now, you said you were a courier going to Moscow, and this would have been in December of?
December, yes.
December of 2000.
Yes.
So we're going back almost a year and a half now. In Moscow, you had some contact with someone who is now deceased, Mark Bastian, is that correct?
Yes, I did.
Was that scheduled? Did you know that you were going to be meeting with this individual before you left Sudbury?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So you did whatever you had to do there, what you were sent to do, which I imagine is something you don't particularly want to talk about?
Not particularly.
Okay. All right. I figured that. So you did what you were doing there. You were doing your job. You then came back by, again, private planes or international flight?
They weren't public transportation method.
Okay. You came back into the country, into Canada.
Right.
And into Sudbury or Toronto?
Came back into Sudbury.
Okay. And
we came back down to Toronto.
Okay. And your intentions here were what?
To pass a pouch off to an individual here in Canada. That individual would have brought that portion of the pouch to the people he worked for, and then I would have returned to the state with another portion of a different pouch.
Were you able to contact the person that you were supposed to hand this off to?
No, I didn't. That's why I never handed it off.
Right. And what did you do when you weren't able to hand this pouch off, or the contents of the pouch off?
I opened it.
Okay. And were you surprised by the contents?
I was a little bit shocked.
Uh-huh.
I would have thought that somebody would have explained to me exactly what it was that was in there. I knew some of the documents that were in there. I knew what they were, because I was sent there specifically for those documents. Some other documents that were in there were documents that were in wax seal envelopes, and I did not know what was in them, but I did open them at some time.
So what were your intentions then? You had the contact that you were supposed to deal with here in Toronto was no longer available to you. How did you feel, and what did you think your next move was going to be?
Well, I was supposed to meet around the 5th, 4th and the 5th, and I went to meet with this person. There should have been two people there, not one. When I got there was only one person there, and the individual told me that Mark Bastian, who is now dead, and he was one of the individuals that I should have met, that he wasn't coming in until around Christmas time, so I was just to give the pouch to him. So what I did is I gave him a blank bag. It was just the pouch was the same pouch, but it had different documents. It had blank papers in it.
So was your feeling then that if you weren't handing it off to the person that you were supposed to be handing it off to, you weren't going to be handing it off to anybody?
No, exactly. That's
standard operating procedure, I suppose, as far as you're concerned.
I wasn't going to hand it off to somebody who had no right to have it.
Right. So, obviously, they received the pouch, looked inside of it. Whatever was supposed to be in there was not in there, and I imagine the search was on for you then, right?
Well, I don't know if it started right then, right away. I know that after I passed off the dummy bag, I made a phone call to somebody and let them know what I did, and they exploded. And I set the meeting up again for the 6th, and I made it in a more public place where there were a numerous amount of people there, and that's when the fugitive squad from Toronto arrested me. But now, nobody knew where I was except for maybe two people.
Now, the person that you contacted that went ballistic when you told them what you had done or not done, were they in Canada or the United States?
Well, they're an American government official, but he is an American government official, but he's in Canada.
I see. They must have contacted the Toronto police.
Oh, they did.
The Metropolitan Toronto Police to apprehend you.
They contacted the Metro Toronto Police, we found out. I got orders to leave the first week of September. But when I got my orders, I wasn't supposed to leave until the last week of November, but I received my orders in September.
Uh-huh.
That was 2000. Mark Bastian received his orders and left on September 7th for Moscow.
Now, Mark Bastian, we should go into a little, just tiny bit of history here. Mark Bastian, or identification, has been identified as a CSIS agent working out of Moscow.
He right. He works at the Canadian Embassy in Moscow.
Well, he did work.
Did work.
Now, when did you find out that not only would Mark Bastion not be returning to the country to meet with you, but he wouldn't be returning to the country alive?
I found out, well, I can't say that it was positive, but I wrote a letter to Mark Bastion around June of 2000 when I was in jail, and I sent it to CSIS headquarters to the director and asked them to have it couriered back to him. They got the letter, and someone came to see me, actually two people, two members of the RCMP NSIS. They came and saw me in August, and they told me that he was positively dead, but they had told my lawyers prior to that that he was most definitely dead. They never said he was murdered. They said that, I guess, he died of natural causes. So I found out in August of 2000.
Now, when they told you that he died of natural causes, what was your thought about that?
I told them right to their face, if he's dead, that's not what happened, that he was murdered.
Right. And we're talking about a 35-year-old man, right?
Yes.
Healthy looking?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. And so now you're in incarceration now. The story then is that you are incarcerated here in Toronto. Where were you exactly?
Well, actually, they locked me up in the Don jail, but they transferred me to a jail up north and just left it. If anybody looked, basically everybody thought that I was in the Don jail. If you look at the articles that are spanning the globe right now, everybody says the Don jail, but I was not in the Don jail. I was in the jail up out by Lindsay.
And so your court dates, and how many court dates would you have had in the time you were incarcerated? How many times were you actually brought into a court of law?
Oh, geez. Probably. As far as the criminal charges go, I was brought to court actually 19 times, and they postponed every one of them. And then as far as the extradition goes, I was brought to court only when Paul Slansky was retained by me. And when I retained Rocco Galletti, I was just then started, they started bringing me into court for the charter application that I filed. And that was, I think they brought me to court 15 times over that from Lindsay.
How long does it take to get down there?
It was about, depending on traffic, I don't know how Canadian or the Toronto traffic is. Maybe 2 hours, 2.5 hours each way.
Uh-huh.
They escort, give the van an escort and ATF escort both ways each time.
And what kind of accommodations did you have during that period of time? What is it like up there? I would imagine, is it better or worse? Were you ever in the Don jail?
Oh, yes, I was in the Don
jail. So how would you compare the accommodations you had there as opposed to the Don jail?
The Roach Motel would be the Don, and I guess the Crown Plaza would be out in Lindsay.
Uh-huh.
It's a very big difference if you want to, you know, label it as an accommodation.
Yeah.
It's a big difference in the Don jail, which is completely run by fools and people just, the jail is so old, it's unbelievable. The people that are inside there are basically a bunch of psychopaths. I'm talking about inmate and officer. The Lindsay jail is completely different. It's run in a more professional manner. I mean, they have control of their jail. They know what's going on in their jail at all times. The Don jail does not.
I think I'll just tell our audience, we're speaking, I'm almost amazed we are, we're speaking to Delbert Mike Vreeland. If you've been following this story, which has mainly been covered by Michael Rupert on his From the Wilderness website, which is linked on the International Connection site, which again is at members.rogers.com/International Connection. And if you look up Vreeland, V-R-E-E-L-A-N-D, if you look that up on the internet, you put in Vreeland and Naval Intelligence on Google, you'll come up with, well, you won't come up with lots of information. You'll come up with the same article many times on different websites, and you'll also find that information that Mike was talking about, his relatives on occasion. You'll find references to 1907, Mike's famous relative. We haven't got to the reason beyond the fact that you were involved in some kind of an operation that involved naval intelligence, CSIS in Canada, Moscow, international intrigue, as I suppose one would say. How long have you been employed doing this kind of work?
That specific kind of work since 1986.
Right.
Enlisted in July of 1984.
And have you had any trouble like this before?
Never.
Things go pretty smoothly, right?
Pretty much. Pretty smooth.
So now you're in Toronto, you're incarcerated, you're in Lindsay, and you're being dragged back and forth to court dates. Initially, from the reports that I have, you were charged with credit card fraud, using your own credit card, evidently, and which Mike Rupert finds funny.
So does the credit card company.
Yeah. And then there was a call by the U.S. government to have you extradited. What arm of the U.S. government demanded your extradition from Canada?
It was just a local government. The actual extradition request went through Washington, D.C. I know that for sure. It says so right on the documents. But it's asking to extradite me back to Michigan for credit card fraud on a credit card that was given to me by the Navy. I mean, it's got my name on it. They're saying that it was fraud, that I committed fraud on the card, but American Express, on three different interviews that we had with them, which is on tape and part of the court record, says there is no fraud and that the card was issued to Lieutenant Vreeland of the U.S. Navy.
Now, the U.S. Navy, or an arm of the U.S. government, in court and I suppose under oath, declared that you had nothing to do with them, that you weren't an employee of theirs, that you maybe had been employed at one time in the past, but that your claims were totally untrue.
Well, they refused to come to court. They would never come to court and say anything. What they did was they told the Canadian government verbally that I was not in the military. Then when we asked for, or they asked the Canadian government, the RCMP members of the Canadian Embassy in Washington asked the United States government for a copy of my military file. They just wanted to have it. The United States government told them, no, you can't have it. So I contacted the Congressional Liaison's office, which is in Tennessee, and I asked for a copy of it, and they have to give it to me. So out of 1,200 and some odd pages, they sent me 56 pages, and all of them were altered. They say that on their documents, it shows that I entered in November of 85, but I have letters that I wrote home to my mother from boot camp in July of 1984. We have the actual original envelopes. Mothers keep stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, she does. I was shocked, actually. I have photographs of the dated, you know, when you take a picture, the camera dates the film, the exposure.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have photographs which are dated after their alleged date of discharge, which would have been March of 1986. Now, if I was only in the military from November of 85 to March of 86, why would I have a military file that is over 1,200 pages?
Mm-hmm.
And then why would they refuse to give up all of the pages? Why would they only come up with 56 pages out of everything? And even inside those documents, there are medical test dates and scores and stuff like that that are dated 1991. Now, they're trying to say that somebody in 1985 or 86 made a mistake and wrote 1991 on the document. I mean, that's impossible for anybody to believe.
Right. So they didn't want to go under oath anywhere.
They still won't.
Yeah.
Now, the courts also told us. We filed a motion. We filed a motion asking them for disclosure, for discovery, as you'd call it.
Yeah.
Disclosure of whatever it is they have in the United States as far as evidence goes saying that I've committed a crime. The courts here said, no, you're not allowed to have that. We said, okay, let us call witnesses. They said, no, you can't do that either. So they want to charge me with a crime that I can prove didn't happen, but they don't want to let me call witnesses. They do not want to let me have any evidence that they allegedly say they have. And it's just, it's not right. Something's wrong with that. You don't do something like that.
So this was all going on, and I'm going to flash forward here to September 11th.
Go ahead.
And the World Trade Center attack occurs. Two planes go into the World Trade Center. Now, when did you find out that this had occurred?
First week of December. I mean, when did I find
out? No, when did you find out that it had actually happened?
That
you're
it
in
actually happened?
Yeah, you're in jail.
I saw it.
You saw it on television.
Yeah, the day it happened. I saw it the day it happened.
Okay, now, what happened after that, and this is why your case became a cause célèbre to a point, and I don't think the media jumped on it as much as obviously as they should have. They never hit the real stories. But you had warned of an attack of this nature. Is this correct?
Yes, I did.
When did you first warn someone? Who did you warn, and what was their reaction?
I first asked to speak to the Canadian military, or CSIS, on December 6th of 2000. I even put it down in writing. It's part of the immigration file. I asked to speak to them. They ignored me. In August, when the RCMP NSIS came, I told them to their face specifically about the World Trade Center. And my comment to them was, when someone bombs or someone nails the World Trade Center, I told them, I said, don't come back to me whining, asking me for information, saying I should have given you more when you're ignoring me now. Then what I did when they left is I was writing a memorandum to Vernon Clark, who's Chief of Naval Operations in the United States. I took a document that I had wrote, and I put it in an envelope. I sealed it, and the the government opened it up on September 14th, 2 days after, or 3 days after. And it was a specific individual who opened it, because it was the same person that knew what was going on and the same one who had taken it from me. He's the one who opened it, and he was gone from work for 3 days. He opened the envelope up on the 14th. He read it, what was inside of it, and it was sealed in August, and he knew it. And they basically, they turned blue.
And when had you written that note?
I wrote that note in August.
August of 2001.
Yes.
Did you know the date that it was going to happen, or did you just know it was going to happen?
I didn't know the exact day and time, no.
Did you know the month?
Yes.
When you were watching television every day as it head into September, were you watching for things developing?
No, I wasn't paying attention to it at all. I was basically, we were working on my own case. I knew something was going to happen in September. And I had just assumed that the United States, I mean, I'm not the only person out there. I know how many people are out there in the field doing what they're doing, so there were warnings coming from all over the place. I mean, we know today that there were warnings coming far and wide to the U.S. government. But basically, I can't say they were all ignored. They couldn't have all been ignored, because FEMA was in New York on the 10th, not the 11th. And they're not just, FEMA might be in New York on a regular basis, but their task force is not set up for major catastrophe in any city, in any part of the United States at any given time.
Right. For our listeners, FEMA is the Federal Emergency Management Agency or whatever, right?
Right. And they were actually in New York the night before. They were set up for this. They knew something was going down. They just didn't know exactly how anything was going to happen. But they knew something was going to happen.
Yeah.
They definitely knew something was happening, but there are individuals that know exactly what was going to happen and when it was going to happen and how it was going to happen, and they let it go.
Well, I know that FEMA officials are usually placed into accommodation, long-term accommodation, in residential neighborhoods and stuff like that, so they need, because they know they're going to be there a long time, but sometimes they don't know why they're there.
True.
So this was unsealed, and as you say, they turned blue, and then what happened?
The letter went straight to Ottawa. It happened really quick. After that letter was made public, basically Rocco Galletti went and tried to speak with the Solicitor General of Canada. And he went up there more than once. He had a scheduled meeting with the guy. The guy blew him off. He ignored him. The RCMP were blowing it off. They were ignoring me. Before September and after. They knew. I told them to their face. They knew. They just didn't want to admit to anybody that they knew, that I told them, and that they just shrugged it off as, oh, the guy's a lunatic. After it happened, they really don't want to talk about it. They really don't want to say, oh, yeah, this guy, he's the guy who told us. You know, they don't want people to know stuff like that.
Right.
So my lawyers kept on trying to get the attention of the RCMP, of CSIS, and basically of Ottawa, and it wasn't happening. We took the charter app, or my lawyers put the charter application together, took that to them, gave them copies of everything we were going to say, and we let them know what I was going to file in court, and we let the U.S. government know what I was going to file in court. They basically just blew it off, so we filed it. Then Nick Prawn from the Toronto Star...
Right.
He wrote an article.
Yes, I have it in front of me.
And after he wrote that article, it was while he was, the day he wrote that article, I don't remember exactly what Mr. Prawn said, but, and I'm not talking about in that article either, but there was a time when he spoke to the people from the U.S. Consulate's office, and after that article hit, the Secret Service was up there, the U.S. Consulate was up there. I mean, I've been bombarded with people saying, okay, what's going on?
We're speaking with Delmert. It's Delmert.
Delmert.
Delmert, Edward Vreeland. We'll call him Mike. And here's the Nick Prawn report, at least one of them, from the Toronto Star. While jet fighters drop bombs on Afghanistan in the wake of the World Trade Center tragedy, an FBI agent search for the source of anthrax letters, an incredible tale has been unfolding in a Toronto courtroom. It draws together the threads of a narrative some describe as, quote, stunning and fantastic, unquote, while others wonder if it isn't just the ravings of a lunatic. The man telling the tale in sworn court affidavits is Delmert Edward Vreeland, who faces credit card fraud charges in Canada and in the United States. In the United States, where officials are attempting to extradite him. The 35-year-old American claims to be a lieutenant in the U.S. Navy Intelligence Unit, has a unit AE, or it doesn't say there, or it's not, it hasn't resolved properly on this printing. A spy who says he knew in advance about the September 11th terrorist attacks. In his affidavit, he says he tried to warn Canadian intelligence about possible terrorist attacks on New York and the Pentagon, along with targets in Ottawa and Toronto, but was written off as a petty criminal. So he wrote the warning on a piece of paper and sealed it in an envelope and handed it to jail guards a month before the attacks. They opened the letter September 14th and immediately forwarded the information to Ottawa. His lawyers, Rocco Galati and Paul Slansky, are fighting extradition, telling the court he could face treason charges and the death penalty in the United States. In the first stage of hearings, federal prosecutor Kevin Wilson yesterday told Mr. Justice Archie Campbell of the Superior Court of Justice that he was skeptical of Vreeland's claims. According to court documents, Vreeland was 18 when he enlisted in the U.S. Navy in 1984. 2 years later, Vreeland says in his affidavit, he joined a special unit investigating drug smuggling into the United States by Navy personnel. But the Navy says Vreeland was unsatisfactorily discharged in 1986. Then it says something about the Michael Rupert and From the Wilderness, that you wrote it on the, something on August 11th or 12th of the year 2000. So, and on this note, it's a chilling sentence follows the list of targets. Let one happen, stop the rest. So that's an article by Nick Prawn from the Toronto Star. I have Delmert, Mike, Edward Vreeland here on the line with me, who is at the center of this storm. So we were at the point where you had filed this as a case. You'd put this an affidavit forth, stating all of these things into court, and the United States government, and they were trying to extradite you. When did they first try to extradite you?
That's the strange part. What they did is they contacted the Canadian government in actually in November of 2000, and then what happened when I got arrested on December 6th, they didn't ask for extradition for 8 months. They didn't ask for anything until I started speaking out. That's when they filed for extradition.
So, now, what? So when they filed for extradition, what went through your mind?
They want me back.
Yeah,
they want me back, and they want me to shut up. I mean,
yeah.
I've had telephone calls from Captain Ritter, who works for JAG. I've got letters from members of JAG telling me that I was violating certain, like, Code 14s or authorizations to testify in court of law. Any government or military personnel who testifies in a court of law to anything in open form must have permission prior to doing so from JAG. It's called Code 14. It's under USCA 725-1 and through 725-11. And it basically, it was a threat. If I open my mouth, I'm going to go to jail. But they're not putting that on the record in court. They're just sending it to me. I have letters from other members of JAG in the California sector saying that this discharge that you see that is inside the file they sent, if you notice, there's no signatures on any of your documents. No one's ever discharged you. Being absent from the military without proper discharge authorization would constitute me as being AWOL and a crime. I've got those types of actual letters from JAG. I've got phone calls from Captain McCarthy, Captain Ritter. I've got phone calls from 20 different legal people from JAG in the military. I've got phone calls from the Secret Service and other individuals, and I've taped all of them. I mean, I wasn't taping them. They were leaving messages on a voicemail that I have, is what they were doing. It's just so ridiculous. It's not even funny. It's just so hard to explain it. Whoever is doing what they're doing, they're stupid at what they're doing. They're constantly tripping over their own feet.
So this is now in September and October. It's hit the newspaper, and you're being dragged into court, and they're trying to get you extradited to the United States, and they're saying that you have nothing to do with naval intelligence or hadn't had anything to do with it for a long, long time, and that even when you did, that you were a low-level functionary. Is that correct?
That's what they tried to say, yeah.
Tell us about this amazing thing that happened in open court, the phone call that occurred.
What happened is my lawyer asked me, is there any way to prove anything at all that we can show the court right now to prove that you're a member of the military? And I said, well, you can always call the Pentagon and ask. And Kevin Wilson, the Crown, he, you know, had a fit. Oh, that's not proper, blah, blah, blah. Justice McDonald said, you know what? He goes, if he calls the Pentagon and they verify, he goes, I want to hear this. Basically, the judge was just, if I want to hear what's going on. So my attorney, Paul Solansky, went and bought a speakerphone, actually, and he plugged it into the courtroom. He called Information in the United States and asked for a number for the Pentagon. The operator that he called is just a regular operator, 1-555-1212. You ask for the number for the Pentagon in the United States. They give you a telephone number which links you to the Department of Defense operator. He got through to the Department of Defense operator. He was transferred through to the Pentagon operator. He asked the Pentagon operator if she could find my office. She said yes. She verified who I was, that I was a lieutenant in the U.S. Navy. She verified what office I was in. She verified the phone number to that office. And she verified that it was active. I was current at the Pentagon. And this was all in open court, and it's part of the court record. Then they come back a month later and try to cover it up.
Who tried to come back?
Well, Kevin Wilson. This is not his doing, though. I'm not going to say this is Kevin Wilson's doing. Somebody came back a month later. They postponed on that day for the Christmas holiday. When we came back to court after the Christmas holiday, the local Michigan sheriff writes a letter, all right, not the United States government, as stated by Kevin Wilson. He says that they contacted the U.S. government, but a sheriff in a small town in Michigan does not constitute a member of the United States government. He's exactly what he is. He's a small town sheriff. He's a nobody. They contact him. He made a phone call according to him. We can't verify what he's done, but he comes up with a 3-page memorandum saying that I had called the Pentagon from jail and tricked the Pentagon operator into putting my name on the telephone directory, then listing me as lieutenant, picking a specific room in the Pentagon, which happens to be an OPNAV room. I'm not going to say what room, but he's saying that I did all this over the telephone from jail. And then he's saying that I also sent an email to the Pentagon from jail. And he produces this as evidence, a copy of an email, which is not even an email. You can look at it and you can tell it's not an email. And he says that's how my name got listed on there, that I had tricked them. I tricked the United States Pentagon into listing me as an officer in the military and giving me my own office in the military and my own phone number in the military in the Pentagon.
they were sort of, weren't they intimating that you'd hacked into the military and that you had changed the files? You had this ability to change the files at the same time as saying that you were a low-level functionary and you really didn't know that much?
They contradicted themselves twice, sure. First, I was too stupid to be the person that bought, that they would send to Moscow to check out the technology. And then they come back saying that I had tricked the people at the Pentagon, and someone has made the comment that I hacked into the computers at the Pentagon and changed this stuff. The problem is I'm in jail. I don't have a computer, and the specific computers that he's speaking on that he knows nothing about are not even online. You can't hack into something that's not online. They're stationary computers. They're not online.
So now this court case went on, and these amazing things happened in court. Can you just tell me what the look on the people's faces were and what your demeanor was when this phone call went through and the Pentagon says that you actually have that you have an office there? Like, can you just tell me I would have loved to have been there when that happened. Can you just describe what that was like?
It was very silent in the courtroom. The judge, they recessed right after that happened. Kevin Wilson basically, he had no composure at all, none. He didn't say anything, he didn't do anything, he just objected to it being entered into evidence. He basically wanted to find a way, as soon as he could, to discredit the phone call. That was the only thing on his mind, was discrediting that phone call. I don't know if I can go as far to say that Kevin Wilson was trying to just discredit it, or if he was trying to find out if the phone call was real and if I was telling the truth. I believe he was just trying to discredit me, because there was so much evidence that I did have, that we did offer up. And he came up with some Alice in Wonderland theory every time my lawyers put something to him. It's like they're living in Disney World. These things just do not happen. You don't hack into the Pentagon computer system when it's not online. And you don't call the Pentagon from jail, collect, or on a three-way, or however, and convince somebody at the Pentagon to put you on that computer system. It doesn't happen that way. You know, it just doesn't happen. That's all I can say, is it doesn't happen that way.
So were you surprised that when that call was made, that they actually had you still on the list?
No, I wasn't surprised at all.
Why?
Because I knew I was still on the list.
Okay, you said that a lot of these people are inept. Would you think that one of the first things that they would do if they had a concern about you would be to remove you from that list, to try to wipe out any record that you even existed?
Well, that's sure. If you try very, very hard to completely annihilate somebody's existence, if you try too hard, you're going to screw up. I mean, when people start to do things like that, they're going to make a mistake somewhere.
Yeah.
They're going to make some type of mistake somewhere. The high school records in the military record are wrong. It says inside the military record that they sent up here that my employment prior to the military was tool and die when I was 13 years old. It says that I was a cook at some company when I was 12 years old. And it's ridiculous. You know, it says that kind of thing inside that file. there's so many inaccuracies inside the files that they sent. It's the fact that they didn't remove me from that system out there is not shocking to me. And when the Pentagon got hit, if they changed systems and they went back to an old system, because their new system from I don't know who owns, I think Verizon set up the new system. If their new system was hit and went down and they went back to the old system, I would still be in the database from the old system.
Yeah.
They're saying that I'm definitely not there now. I'm saying, well, I'm sure they've removed me now. I'm pretty positive they have, but it's too late now because we have it on court record.
So you're out of jail now. When did that happen?
March 15th.
So just about a month ago.
Yes. Almost a month.
And on what terms were you released?
$5,000. Had to tell them exactly where I was living. No weapons. I have to report once a week, every Monday, to somebody.
Uh-huh.
And then I have a curfew.
And the charges are still active?
Well, the criminal charges that they had in here in Canada.
Yes.
No, them are gone.
Those are gone. So the
they've dismissed those completely. They actually didn't even show up to court when they were supposed to on three different occasions for us to fight those charges. They didn't even come in because they I won't speculate on why they didn't show up.
Yeah.
I can just say that they didn't show up and then they withdrew the charges.
Now, those charges were what?
It was fraud, threatening death. I think there was an obstruction of justice charge in there. There were five different charges. I don't know. I tell you the truth, I don't know exactly
what
they
were. Were they all related to things that happened in Canada, or did it have anything to do with what had occurred in the with these supposed charges out of Michigan in the United States?
It had nothing to do with the charges in the United States. There was, someone had said that I was charged here in Canada with credit card fraud here in Canada also. That was not true. I'm not going to say who printed it or who did it. If somebody sees it, that's fine. I'm not bashing the guy for doing it. Someone gave him wrong information, and he printed it that way. But there were no credit card fraud charges in this country.
So the ones, the credit card fraud charges are still active from the United States, or is it just the extradition request is still active from the United States?
Credit card charges in the United States are what they're basing the extradition upon.
Right.
So they can't, if they drop the credit card,
then they can't extradite you. Okay, I'm going to ask a couple of questions here, and I know that they may be problematic for you, but I'll just go ahead anyway. Did you know about the September 11th, or what would eventually happen in September 11th, or this general idea about a building being hit by an airplane or by something? Was that information that you found out about because you opened the pouch?
Yes.
And was it seen as being a concern of those that were that in the pouch? In other words, is this something that they had foreknowledge of something happening? Like that they, or a suspicion that something was going to happen?
There's one letter in there. There's one document that I don't know if it's actually public document, but I know we gave it to the government, which specifically speaks on September 11th. Doesn't say the 11th. I don't think it says specifically the 11th, but it says September, and it talks about something happening to the World Trade Center, specifically between two different governments. It was a communication from one government to another one.
Now,
letting them know what was going to happen.
Now, the material that was in the pouch that you held up until that day where you were apprehended on December 6th of the year 2000, were you in control of those documents when you were apprehended?
Absolutely. When I was apprehended, I didn't even bring them with me.
You didn't bring them with you?
Nope. On the second meeting, I didn't bring them at all.
When the police apprehended you, you didn't have the material with you?
Nope.
And is the material still... Okay, so where's the material now?
It's in Canada.
It's in Canada somewhere?
Yes.
Is it in control of the authorities?
No.
So only you know where it is?
I won't say that. No, I'm not the only one who knows where it is.
Okay.
That would be dumb for me to do
that way. Yeah.
My lawyers don't know, and no member of the Canadian government knows. No one in my family knows, but there is one person who knows where the stuff is at.
And
the originals.
Did the court ever ask for that to be brought in?
Yeah, they did. Justice McDonald basically said it was an adverse inference he was assuming against me because I refused to give them the documents. And my only answer to that is that's the whole problem. This whole issue is over these documents. So I'm supposed to give them to this court? So what? The court can seal them and hide them?
Uh-huh.
Exactly what would happen. I'm not saying Justice McDonald would do anything wrong. I'm saying that's what would happen with the documents. It would be out of his control before he had a chance to get it in his control.
So how insistent are they that you provide these documents?
They want the documents.
Uh-huh.
I mean, even though they're saying they don't exist, they still call me and tell me, you know, I have somebody that called me from the Secret Service asking me to call him. This is why I was in jail. To call him so we could arrange to have the documents picked up. And he leaves this message on my voicemail with his telephone number. You call it and you ask for him. He's a Secret Service agent. They answer Secret Service, you know, so on and so forth. But the documents are safe. I don't know what all of them are because I did not open every page.
Uh-huh.
I did not open everything. I opened the majority as much as I could in the time frame that I had.
Yes.
But they're here and they're safe. They're not with me. They're not in my apartment or anything like that.
All right. What are your plans?
What are my plans?
Yeah. Like, let's say that these charges, the extradition request, the charges in Michigan are dropped. What are your plans now? I mean,
I'm going to bring the documents public. That's the best thing for me to do is to bring them public, because you can't let something like September 11th happen and then hide the truth of what really happened, who was behind it, and who had knowledge of it, the fact that it was going to happen, and let them get away with it. Let them get away with not doing something about it.
Uh-huh.
They could have stopped it. They could have stopped those planes.
Right.
And anybody who says that they couldn't have is a liar. Anybody who believes that government officials in the United States did not know, if they believe it just because they don't want to believe it, that's the only reason they believe it, is because they don't want to believe it. Because they knew. The United States government, someone in there knew what was going on. I'm not giving anybody's name. I'm not saying anyone specific. I'm just saying they knew. They knew what was going on. And they did nothing about it. Same thing with Roosevelt. Look what Roosevelt did. I mean, he let him bomb Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Just so he could get involved in the war. He knew it was going to happen. And people don't find out that, you know, for 20, 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
No? So it's the same issue. If Roosevelt can do it and get away with it, why can't somebody else?
Well, Mike, this is an incredible story, and I feel really privileged that you've come on this program and told us straight from you. I made many inquiries to your lawyers without any response. And
very busy, fellas.
I know. I'm just really happy that you've come on and told your side of the story and been as open with me as you have been. And is there anything else that you'd like to say before we go? I can't really think of anything more. Any more questions? I probably will once I'm off the air, but is there anything else that you'd like to say?
No, not really. I don't have anything to add to it.
Yeah.
Other than, I mean, it's the charges in the states and the record in the states, the criminal stuff, it's just fraud. The naval record, it's fraud. They know it. I know it. And it's going to come out eventually. It's not going to be hidden forever. It's going to come out in the courthouse. It's going to come out on the regular press. It's going to come out the mainstream media.
When is your next date in court scheduled for?
I don't want to say that out loud on the radio.
All right, okay, yeah.
Okay.
All right, there is a court date set at some point, and you're going to be in there again.
Right.
Okay, well, we wish you all the best of luck. You and I will be in touch, I hope, and if there's anything else you want to put out over the air, I'd certainly be more than happy to be the conduit for that. So we've been speaking with Delmart, Edward, Mike Vreeland. You've heard of the whole story. Thanks very, very much, Mike, for being on the air with me on the International Connection this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye. Well, that was really interesting, and that's one of the most interesting interviews we've had here in the International Connection since I've been on here, and I want to thank Mike for doing that. Going to go for a quick break, and we'll be back with the segue into the Aquino Estro America.